Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 3rd of April 2012 here in Japan, the 2nd of April 2012 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by John Rappaport, an investigative reporter and the man behind NoMoreFakeNews.com. And he has a new CD set called The Matrix Revealed, containing tons of information, including an entire lecture series on logic and analysis, the text of AIDS Inc., and much, much more besides, hundreds of megabytes of information. So, John Rappaport, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, James. Good to be here.
Well, let's start today with some rather jaw-dropping ideas and articles that have been coming out recently from the realm of bioethics. And for those who don't know, I suppose it may be shocking to be reading things in the Journal of Medical Ethics like afterbirth abortion, why should the baby live, talking openly about the possibility of allowing afterbirth abortions, actually post-birth abortions in which newborn babies are killed, not even because of any abnormalities or deformities, but simply because the parent doesn't want them. And these types of debates happening with increasing frequency in the medical world, and specifically in the realm of bioethics, but of course not really filtering down to the general public very much. Although that particular story did catch on and was published in a number of newspapers. But for people who are just coming into this and don't really understand the context of these ideas or where these kind of jaw-dropping ideas are coming from, perhaps we can talk a little bit about the background of bioethics.
Okay, sure. Bioethics is considered to be an academic discipline at universities. And so you have professors who specialize in bioethics. And their job is to decide what's moral and what's immoral about where science is heading, particularly biological sciences. Now, this is a rather strange field of inquiry because, you know, how much does one have to say about this? I mean, you can say, well, you shouldn't take life unnecessarily. But then, of course, you begin to split hairs. And as academics do, these professors want to get published. They want prestige. They want to be noticed. They want tenure. And so the arguments become more complex in various journal papers that are published. Debates are founded on the various subjects so that they can provide back and forth communication. And you get a whole field growing up around questions of what is right and what is not right. And this is to some degree taken out of the hands academically of mere doctors. This is put into the hands of people who are supposed to have, one would assume, what? Higher knowledge about these subjects, and yet we get this piece about killing babies and calling it afterbirth abortion. So that sort of sets the stage a little bit. To me, I would have to say this is not a genuine field of academic expertise. People sort of muscle their way into this. And they try to rely on reputations and what universities are teaching at and so forth in order to make their own pronouncements.
Well, I think you're right in that assessment. So let's get into some of the details and some of the people who are behind this so-called academic discipline. And we can look, for example, at someone like Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, the brother of Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff of the White House and current mayor of Chicago, who actually in 2009 was quoted as arguing against the use of the Hippocratic Oath in the medical profession because it was an obstacle to allowing sick people to drop dead and save the rest of us a monetary burden. So actually quoting from Dr. Emanuel, he argued that, quote, peer recognition goes to the most thorough and aggressive physicians, and then he lamented that the Hippocratic Oath's admonition to use my powers to help the patient to the best of my ability and judgment as an imperative to do everything for the patient, regardless of the cost or effect on others. And unfortunately, we've seen this idea popping up with much more frequency in recent years, and it was mocked quite a bit as death panels by the mainstream media. During the time that that debate was taking place. But interestingly enough, some of the proponents have now openly called them death panels and even joked about it, including even Bill Gates, who was joking about the case for killing Granny and other such things that are becoming mainstream and, of course, are stemming from this bioethics. So what really is the point of this? Where is this coming from and where is this all heading?
It's coming from the idea, you see, that government is paying for all the medical care. That's where it starts. Because, look, if this were a private affair between you and your doctor, why would anybody even be commenting on it? And as I predicted many years ago, if you turn an aspect of society completely over to government and you say, okay, we want everyone to have extensive health care and it should be, quote, free, which means taxpayer funded, government decides where the money goes and allocates and so on and so forth. Government is in charge of this, and there's only a limited amount of money. It's not forever. It's not infinite. Now you set the stage, you see. Now you can have government saying, well, since this is true, now we have to decide who lives and who dies. Suddenly this becomes an ethical question because it's about the money. But people don't make that clear. They may openly say, yes, let's have death panels, but they don't really construct how the whole system is delivered to patients. They just kind of assume that everybody agrees that this is, quote, public money, government is in charge, therefore the government has to decide whether we're going to treat a five-year-old boy with a heart valve problem or we're going to treat an 85-year-old grandmother who has recurrent cancer. Where's the money going to go? But it's not couched in those terms. See, it's couched in terms of what's the right thing to do. And this is, I mean, this is very devious kind of thinking. And I have to say that this is just the beginning. It's going to get a lot worse than this, especially if the United States decides, okay, we want Obamacare. It's constitutional. End of story. So now we're going to talk about, yes, individual mandate to buy, you must buy. The United States now lines up with other nations of the world, progressive nations who have decided that health care should be free for all. Once the United States climbs on board that train, it's going to take off much quicker for all nations in the world because everybody's going to point to the United States and say, well, finally, we're all on the same page. Okay, now let's roll up our sleeves and let's decide how are we going to make this all work globally, not just nationally, because really we're all connected here. And so who's going to live and who's going to die? Let's argue this ethically. This is happening now. It's going to happen at a much higher rate of acceleration.
Well, as I think you point to there, this is actually about a much larger agenda than simply the given issues that are being argued. It's about the idea of the ownership of the individual by society, really, and whether society can be take responsibility for each and every individual, and if so, then do individuals have any say over their own healthcare, for example. But I think the underlying issue here is really one that stems back to an ideology that sprang out of 19th century Victorian England, in which there were some gentlemen scientists that developed the idea of eugenics, and they were basically arguing that that there were a certain breed of human beings who were genetically superior to others and thus deserved to propagate their genes into the future, while the vice-ridden class need to be basically eliminated from the gene pool. And I think we see the development of that idea over the course of decades, and we can trace it, and many researchers have, like Anton Chaitkin, directly from the Eugenics Society of America, which morphed into the Population Council funded by the Rockefellers, which was also used to spring the bioethics movement, really, and was demonstrably used to house and fund the bioethics in its original early stages. So what can you say about that development of eugenics and then crypto-eugenics into this movement to really try to eradicate a certain section of the gene pool?
I mean, you're right in tracing this history, and this is the other thread of the whole argument here about bioethics and who lives and who dies. That American movement was eventually exported to Nazi Germany. It started really here. It then moved to Nazi Germany, and of course, they ratcheted up, you know, thousands of degrees, literally. It is this notion that the fittest should survive. And so it falls to those who have superior knowledge to decide who are the fittest, because that's what we want in the future. I mean, there's much science fiction that backs this kind of thing up. You read H.G. Wells' novel, for example, The Shape of Things to Come. There are others. There's a whole British tradition behind this idea of, in the future, we're going to have a superior kind of human. Well, how do we do this? We have to identify who is inferior and eliminate them, because otherwise they're going to contaminate the gene pool. And so decisions will be made. And we get now up until the present, many different kinds of arguments now coming out of academia. For example, Lee Silver at Princeton University, he argues, let the market decide. In the future, this is what's going to happen. Those who can afford it are going to buy synthetic genes to be inserted into their children, pre or post birth, and those are going to be the most talented, intelligent, able, strong individuals. And this upper crust of society is going to live apart. The rest of society is going to be, quote, the animals, I mean, the lower caste, and they will never interbreed. They will live separately. And so what Silver is saying, it's coming. There's nothing that can stop it. This is how it's going to play out. And he's taking a, quote, libertarian position on it. The market will determine how this comes down. Now, you have other such, quote, thinkers who are arguing as advocates for one side of this or the other. But it's speckled with many different versions now of eugenics or crypto-eugenics, where different people are weighing in. And what's happening as a result of it, and I follow this in my reporting, I can see now that society is softening around the edges vis-a-vis this notion. It's not just, oh my God, that's horrific. People are going, well, maybe that's a good idea. Unbelievable, but it's happening.
Unbelievable, but yes, I certainly see that too, and I think that is a reflection of the type of, I guess, soft sell that's been going on for a long time behind the scenes to introduce people to this and to actually get them to accept these ideas, which I think speaks to a rather inconceivably large PR campaign that's been going on for a long time. But at the same time,
let me finish one other remark here. It's almost like a shell game, you see. On the one hand, we show you, gee, there's a bright future waiting for us up the road if we can learn how to synthesize genes and insert them to make children happier, more intelligent, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody looks at that and says, oh, DNA alteration, wow, that's a great thing. And while people are saying this, at the same time, over here, they're sort of saying, and you see, we do really need to make a choice between those who are fit to live and those who are not. And this is getting all tangled together and is responsible for the softening of the attitude, because people are mixing the two together and not being able to distinguish one thing from another. This is very important.
That's an extremely important point. And I think that also speaks to the fact that there really are medical technologies that are coming up now that that are enabling all sorts of things that would never have been possible before and do raise certain ethical questions in and of themselves. Considering all of the types of medical advances that are coming and the possibility of developing incubators, babies, so to speak, that could be actually raised without a womb, and all sorts of things that just a few short years ago would have been science fiction are becoming more and more medically feasible. So there is a question of how we as a society deal with these technologies, if it's not to put it in the hands of an institutional class of academics that call themselves bioethicists. Where should that decision lie?
Boy, that's a tough one. You know, where the decision should definitely not lie with people who can legislate somehow for all of us. You know, I mean, that's what you want to avoid. You dare not do that, because if you do and say these are the people who are best fit to judge the whole situation and make blanket decisions for everybody, now you really are seriously in trouble. But I will say this. The genes as science, have been way oversold. Because you've got biotech companies out there. I wrote some years ago that the last thing I would do if I were buying stocks is to go into the biotech sector. Because, I mean, these companies became famous 20 years ago or more for lying. Because they were raising money. They were looking for investors. They had scientists out front who were basically pimping for them, saying, we're on the verge of this, and this breakthrough is right around the corner, and if you people just give us your money, you know, it's all going to happen. And, of course, it didn't happen. There is still not a single across-the-board gene cure for any disease. You can't name a disease where somebody will come forward, a doctor, and say, yes, anyone with this disease, we know exactly what to do to insert a gene or deactivate a gene, and that is cured. It's not there. So the whole idea that we're on the verge of this has been way oversold. But I've spoken privately with people in the field. Very shocking and disheartening several years ago and more, who basically said to me off the record, experiments are being done. They're being done on humans, and they're being done in places that you'll never get to see. And they're being done in Nazi-like fashion. In other words, the scientists basically admit they don't have the technology in tow. So it's hit and miss. They're trying this, they're trying that. They don't care what the results are, how grotesque it all turns out. They're working to find answers just the way the Nazis were in the death camps. So I haven't answered your question directly, but my answer is that no one should be legislated away from any technology that really works or forced to enlist in it. Freedom has always got to be the basic issue somehow here. If that's not preserved, it's done.
I think I concur with that assessment. I don't think there can be an outside force that should be able to legislate what can or cannot be done or should not be done to any individual's body. But in that case, wouldn't that really lend itself to the free market solution as proposed by people like Silver?
It does. It does. I mean, you can try to say we're going to ban this across the board, even though we know that a certain genetic insertion works to produce X result, we're going to say you can't do it. As soon as you say that, you're going to have all sorts of people who can afford it finding a way to do it. You now just created a black market for it, and a very lucrative black market. So what I'm thinking here is there's something about the science itself. How can I put this? Regardless of what they are able to do in the next, say, 20 to 50 years, this is a view of the human being that is distorted. To me, another vital point. They're saying basically you are your DNA, and that's all you are. It's all you ever were, except we didn't know it. And now we do, and we can actually spell it out for you if you'd like us to. It determines everything about you, the way you appear, the way you think, what you do, your preferences, your choices, the diseases you get, and so on and so forth. I don't care how much science they develop. I don't think they'll ever get close to that as reality. They may lie about it, but I don't think they'll ever get close to that. Because now we come down to a philosophic question. Is there any such thing as free will? Does it exist? Everything that I know and think gives me the answer, yes, it does. But inherent in the notion of free will is something beyond any genetics at all. If it's not, it's not free will. And this is one of the things that 21st century science wants to eliminate from the conversation. Another issue in bioethics, which is, I would call it a covert issue, is to not bring up this subject. This is not part of the conversation. We don't want to suddenly raise the specter of the independent free individual having free will. That's way beyond our mission statement, which is really about control. It's about control of human beings. What choices we want them to be forced to make. If we admit the notion that you, I are free, that this is actually not just an intellectual statement, but it's real. Now we're saying, you, James, I, John, somehow, and we don't know how, have the capacity to make a choice that is not the result of brain synapses or genes or DNA structure. It goes beyond any of that. It goes maybe back to the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's big trouble for globalists. That's the last thing they want to get involved in.
Well, you draw the point out excellently there. I think it absolutely is the case that the entire bioethics profession and everything that they're talking about is undergirded by a specific socio-political structure that they're assuming to already exist and to be in place, the ability of a government to dictate what can or cannot or should not be done with individuals. And of course, that is only applicable within a certain socio-political context. So without questioning that fundamental assumption, what's the point of the entire debate itself? But I think you also raise another very important point when you talk about the scientific fraud and quackery that goes along with a lot of this that's used in the free market to try to sell it to people who are willing to buy it, I suppose. And you point to the biotech companies that 20 years ago were promising the moon in order to get funding. And eugenics itself, of course, was total pseudoscientific quackery that and all sorts of preposterous things were proposed that turned out to be completely incorrect in the pursuit of that ideal of those racist eugenicists of the 19th century. And we can look to GMO foods, for example, or GMOs that were promised to be these wonder crops that would require less pesticide and produce more yield, etc., etc., when the exact opposite has proven to be the case. It requires more pesticides. It actually produces lower yields, let alone all of the health effects. Time and time again, we come up against these scientific frauds and quackery in pursuit of these types of ideas. Can you speak to just the overall way in which this scientific fraud is perpetuated and how it really filters down to society as some sort of, you know, perfect shining example of what we should all be following, the scientific method?
Well, it's done by using the word science, of course. I mean, as a reporter, and in the product that you mentioned, The Matrix Reveal, that I just released, I have interviews with insiders, particularly one who's a retired propaganda master of the game. And he has described to me in many different ways how he was able to influence the press and get them to print stories. And we're talking now medical stories in large part, cultivating reliable sources who would then become, you know, are the sources for the reporters. And he's standing back from that, and he knows the reliable sources. And he is feeding them advanced information on what's happening at the cutting edge of medicine and science and so forth. This is an entire propaganda operation. And of course, when you have, quote, experts out front talking, doctors, medical bureaucrats and so forth, we're on the verge of this, we've done that, we've just created an experiment where we were able to prove this. How many times as a reporter, I mean, I've seen these articles, you know, on the verge of a breakthrough, or the first study that was able to show such and so with genes, and you read down and you find out, oh, they're talking about a pilot project with insects. This is what you find out in the 10th paragraph, you know. At first you thought it was humans. They will, you know, create these stories any way they want to for the sake of the headline. And if you or I had the access to the press to run hundreds and hundreds and maybe thousands of these stories a year, in sections of major media outlets and barraging the public with this idea that, you know, paradise is near and we're almost there, well, we would convince a large number of people that that's the case. But it's very right of you to bring this up, because if you just look at the population now, everybody thinks he's a DNA expert. Well, you know, why does he act that way? The age-old questions of human behavior. Did you see what he did or she did? And someone comes along who is purported to be humane and says, well, you know, don't blame them. I mean, it's their genes. That's the way they're built. Oh, yeah, you know, it's this notion that's taken hold ever since the rise of science, really, in the West, especially the biological sciences, that we can fully understand the human being by knowing how the human being is constructed. And we're adding one more piece at a time to the puzzle. And this is very appealing to, quote, the rational mind. It makes sense. Before there was superstition, there was mystery, there was fraud, there was quackery and snake oil, but now we have science, which of course is free from all of that. And so, you know, my career for the last 30 years, in one sense, has been to prove that's a lie. There's more fraud and quackery now in science than anyone could ever have imagined. It's just rampant, and I've documented it, you know, all over the place. And here's another aspect, the genetic mission or project. It's a propaganda effort that dominates the media to sell this idea to the public. It could be apples, it could be cars. It's the same technique.
Well, we've mentioned your CD, the Matrix Revealed. Let's talk about some of the other things that you have available at No More Fake News.
Well, as part of The Matrix Revealed is a book that I wrote in 1988 called AIDS Inc., which is an examination of the science behind trying to find the answer to the cause of AIDS. It was my first introduction to real deep medical fraud. A book that I wrote in 1999 called The Secret Behind Secret Societies, also available. It was an investigation that I did into a secret society view of shaping the world. If you were going to shape the world, what would you be doing? What are you trying to do to alter perception? What are you trying to do to set up people's thinking, their main ideas in such a way that they see the reality that you want to paint for them and none other? And how deep does this go in the human psyche? How, you know, exposed are we? How vulnerable are we to accepting the reality that someone else imagines for us? That was really the core of that book. And that was a lifelong search on my part, really, to try to see if you can understand how these organizations try to paint a picture of reality for the public, what can you see about the inherent potential in the individual to create his or her own reality? And what would that even mean? And what does that say about consensus reality that we all apparently share? And how is that built? And what would happen if it weren't here? Questions of this magnitude. So those are a few of the things that are on my website. And of course, I write articles, you know, on nearly a daily basis that I post there. We're talking about genes here. You know, to me, this is a fresco. It's a mural that's being painted for the world. This is what the genetic future is going to look like, and we're almost there. Let us bring you into the Great Hall and show you the mural so that you can see what is here. And this is bolstered by many preconceptions that people already have about the world, about themselves, about, as I say, how the human being is built and so forth. And so when the scientist says, look at this, people are in awe. They just think it's absolutely fantastic. And they make these analogies. Well, if a scientist can go into a laboratory and mix six chemicals together and always get the same result, time and time, he knows. He knows. You see. So if he's telling me about genes, he must know about that too. The analogies are endless. You know, if an ambulance can pick you up off the street after you've just been smashed by a car, and they can take you to a hospital and doctors can put you back together again, then anything that doctors or medical bureaucrats say about medicine must be true. Anything in the treatment of chronic disease, cancer, whatever they say, genetics, it must all be true because we have other analogies that we can point to. And they sell that, believe me. They're selling that all the time. They are artists constructing a picture of reality for us. What are we doing? What can we together, what can we as individuals do to invent our own reality, and how far can that potentially go? And, you know, I go all the way back to ancient Tibet, which isn't so ancient, really. What were those magicians out on the tundra trying to do? What were the techniques they were using? What were the exercises they were involved in, which were really not what you would call religious-based at all? I did a lot of research on this and discovered some remarkable things that have to do with the individual creating reality and how far one could take that. So that's, you know, some of what I'm into.
Well, absolutely fascinating stuff. And perhaps we can use that for an entree into our next conversation, because I certainly hope that you will be on the program in the future to continue this discussion. Absolutely incredible, remarkable stuff. So John Rappaport, nomorefakenews.com. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James. I really enjoyed being here.